You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Now, in these podcasts, we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer, and I specialize in food and science. Today's podcast is all about the UK's food system beyond the 1st of January 2021. Now, we're recording this episode on the 16th of December. There's still no sign of a trade deal with the EU, but even if there is a trade deal, it's fair to say that the food industry and the entire supply chain is still facing its biggest challenge of modern times, because we haven't known and we still don't know what a deal would look like. Now, we are not here to debate Brexit. Obviously, we're going to talk about it, but we have to look at its impact in the short and long term to the food and beverage industry. Today's panel is an absolutely stellar assembly of experts who are perfectly placed to talk us through this. We have Ian Wright, Chief Executive of the Food and Drink Federation.
Hello.
Dr. Elitsa Garnizova, Director of LSE Consulting's Trade Policy Hub.
Hello.
David Wells, Chief Executive of Logistics UK.
Hello.
And Professor Tony Herron, who's the Professor of International Political Economy at the University of York.
Hello.
Ian, we'll start with you. With negotiations still rolling on with such a lack of clarity, how have businesses been preparing for the end of transition in the context of the food industry having to cope with multiple different scenarios?
Well, it's clearly a very tricky time, because alongside the continuing uncertainty that attends Brexit, we also have constantly changing restrictions on COVID. And although the food industry is prioritised and key worker status has been given to everybody in the food industry, food and manufacturing and retail industry and farmers, there is this concern that is driven by the changing patterns of consumption. So when hospitality is open and when contract catering is going on in workplaces or other venues, and when food to go, sandwich shops and so on is available, then the need for manufacturers to produce different products is high. And it's quite difficult to predict whether you will be producing for hospitality or not. Particularly over Christmas, where the rules are clearly going to be released a bit. So we're battling all of that, plus the question of how much we produce over Christmas for what might or might not be a Christmas rush. And there are all sorts of different anecdotal stories about that. So I think it is a confusing picture. I think Brexit will bring other complications, particularly as the different trade flows have different potential for chaos. So those between UK and EU and EU and UK will have different levels of concern and different concerns from those related to GB to NI and NI to GB. So it is both a confusing and still a very uncertain picture, with only a very small number of working days to go.
And with, I mean, I know it's a little bit of a cliche to call it a perfect storm, but it sort of is, isn't it? And with the fact that there are so many variables, have you seen firms trying to cope with multiple scenarios, or are they just waiting to see?
Well, it's both. So the bigger firms and the better resource firms have probably prepared for multiple different scenarios, as in, if this happens, we will do these things. If that happens, we will do these other things. But smaller firms just don't have the resource to do that, particularly at a time when they're, you know, basically battling for survival. I think one perhaps counterintuitive thing that some firms will do in the face of uncertainty is not supply specific markets. Mm-hmm. So I think you could imagine that where, for example, it's not clear what processes will be required in Northern Ireland, about half our member companies who supply Northern Ireland have said that they won't participate in that market in the first couple of months of the new year because it's just too uncertain.
Mm. Tony, has a scenario like this ever existed, as far as you know?
I think in recent times, probably the most comparable episode you could talk to is in 2008 with the global food crisis, mm-hmm. when UK food prices increased by about 12%. So that's more on the kind of on the consumption sort of side of end. But in terms of the kind of scale of the economic shock, I can't think of really of a modern precedent, just in terms of the you know, the nature and the scale of the change and the adjustment that's going to occur. But certainly in terms of the effects for consumers, there are, you know, we you know, as Ian was suggesting, we've already had some challenges in relation to COVID, and we saw some of the effects with some of the stockpiling in the early period of the pandemic in March and April, where we saw issues of stockpiling and shortages of some food as consumers began to behave in ways not consistent with their previous sort of purchasing behavior.
But there's no sort of grand scale comparison that we can make, and therefore predictions are relatively hard, I guess. Now, Eliza, before we dive into the specifics of this for the industry, and we are a podcast aiming at the food industry, I'm interested in what you can predict that consumers are likely to see in the short term after the 1st of January.
Consumers are, just as Ian and Tony explained, they're highly exposed to any changes in the future relationship. So what we know is that initially, day one, of course, when we talk about short term, on the first day, we don't actually expect major shocks, just because most of the producers are either stockpiling or are going to absorb the costs initially. But mid next year, which could also be seen as short term for our purposes, we do see quite a bit of a change for consumers. So first of all, increased prices for both branded and unbranded products, especially for specialty products, but also reduced availability for some of the things that we use on a daily basis. So even when we talk about price increases, we talk about some of the daily stuff such as butter, cream, milk. But on the specialty side, some of our favorites on the table, such as halloumi, feta, gorgonzola, they'll definitely see some of the highest price hikes.
Now, David, I'm amazed that we even have you on here. You must be the busiest man on the planet, because the logistics issues of this are spectacular. Can you give us the breakdown of the main issues that the logistics side of the industry faces?
So I think we need to sort of think about it in, so I'm going to talk about three things, really. The first is the flow between the sort of logistics of moving product between the EU and the UK, and then moving product from the UK back into the EU. I liken that trade flow as a bit like a conveyor belt of trucks. Now, the government have basically said that they will allow trucks into the UK at the same level of checks that are going on at the moment, and they won't impose new checks and controls until halfway through next year. That's fine. That keeps the conveyor belt moving in the direction of EU to UK. And then you've got the issue of moving trucks from the UK back into the EU with product that's being exported. Now, there, I think the picture is very different. 80% of trucks that cross between the UK and the EU are European registered. They are driven by European drivers. The challenge for the industry and for the government is to educate foreign drivers in what processes will be required at Dover and then into the EU. That's a really difficult challenge. The government are translating at pace lots of their documentation in order to inform drivers. Then you've got the issue of, okay, so if you stop that conveyor belt, then the product, and in this case foodstuffs that we're talking about, food product, will stop, because if the conveyor belt stops at any point, that whole process grinds to a halt. The second thing I would highlight is that process is very dependent on importers, exporters into the EU getting their documentation right. The government have what they call the high value exporters in the economy, and they account for 92% of UK-EU trade. In a recent survey, only 56% of those exporters had contacted their customers in the EU to understand, to agree with them, who was going to do safety and security declarations and make the necessary collaboration over the documentation required to import into the EU. Now, why is that important to the food industry? Well, because of this conveyor belt principle. If you stop that conveyor belt, then foodstuffs will stop coming in. It's like a sort of ecosystem, really, that if you stop it at any point, you do have a detrimental effect on the UK and its economy.
And the food industry aspect of this is that it's very much a just-in-time supply chain system. Is that right?
Well, it used to be said that the major retailers had around 3 days of stock. Ian may be able to comment on that. It's certainly the case that, as product, which is perishable product, sits in the back of a truck, for every hour you get a significant deterioration in the shelf life. And it's not a straight one-to-one relationship. So clearly, this is a very tight cycle in time and quality of the food product that gets onto our shelves. So there is significant risk, I think, to major retailers of delays and the impact that will have on the choice and also the quality of perishable products.
So Ian, what would you say is the most critical part of this? Is it the logistics, or is it simply the costs and whether or not costs can be absorbed or passed on? Which is the bit that worries you and your members most?
Well, until a week ago, I would have said that my biggest concerns lay around Northern Ireland. I think a lot of effort and time and a lot of planning has gone into the links between the UK and the EU, particularly around the short straits at Dover-Calais. And I think if anything can work well, it will be that. I don't know that it will, but the amount of planning and the level of resource that's been poured into that by government and others is very considerable. I think there is a big question mark about over the first months, the readiness of European hauliers and traders in the sort of second tier of businesses. I think big players like Nestle or Kellogg's or Coke will be well served, but it's others who only move goods on a weekly or bi-weekly, fortnightly basis that will be the ones that where you need to worry. And of course, the point is not how well prepared and how well organized are you, it's what is the person in front of the queue's level of readiness, because only needs one to stop the whole thing. But and that applies even more, in my view, to the Northern Ireland trade. And although we've seen a lot of easements and a lot of grace periods being put in place as a consequence of the Gove-Stefanovic agreement last week, I'm still quite worried about, I don't think enough testing has been done at either Cairn Ryan, which is Stranraer to Belfast, or at the Welsh ports, to know whether they will work properly. And then the final thing I'd say, sorry to go on a bit, is that there's a completely non-Brexit related issue at Felixstowe, which is the main container port for ambient food, where the Felixstowe port is operating well below capacity and has been for many weeks. And I'm just a bit concerned that if you've got a COVID outbreak or some issue that we haven't predicted that stops things going through Felixstowe even more than it is at the moment, the buffer of ambient food, tinned food, packaged food that comes in from there that we think will keep us going in the event of some other difficulty on the routes I've just described won't be available. And I think that that's a sort of second biggest fear for me.
So there's a sort of secondary set of vulnerabilities that where if scenarios shift, then we're going to be in deep trouble. So Elitsa, this is an interesting point that Ian's made. What would you say are the weak points of the supply chains? Where are these main vulnerabilities and what should we be most wary of?
So for some of the things that our study particularly focused on, so what we looked at in particular, and that's important to say on while we still don't have an idea of whether there will be a deal or no deal, that when it comes to most of the non-tariff measures and administrative and regulatory burdens, these will apply in either scenario. So it doesn't, even if we're optimistic and we say that when this is there will be a deal, those costs will still remain. And this is really important, especially for those that do not export on a daily or even weekly basis, or those companies that have mostly served the UK or and the EU market before. So they have to learn to do everything anew. So it's also those technical aspects in making sure that the system can cope with the new demands. So there is that perspective. And on the side of what we also looked at is also labor availability. So there are a lot of, as you know, a lot of Europeans employed in the food and beverage sector. So we see an extra weakness in when it comes to those unskilled occupations and the potential disruption with that regard. So these are just some of the additional disruptions that we've seen.
So, Tony, this is really interesting. So, a few people have mentioned this now, that smaller companies will be affected more than the larger companies who can possibly cope with change a little bit better. If smaller companies suffer and some go under, how will this change the structure and the nature of the food industry and its financial basis and the balance between smaller companies and larger companies, suppliers and distributors and manufacturers?
That's a good question. I think, I mean, one thing to understand about the UK food sector, it's already really heavily concentrated. So, that's the point of distribution and retail. Actually, at the supply end, it's much more, it's much more diverse. As Elitsa and Ian have been saying, I think that the big companies are likely to have the capacity to deal and absorb the extra costs with customs declarations, with SBS checks and other bits of bureaucracy that are likely to come even in the event of a deal. So it could see the exit for smaller players in the industry. So we're likely to see a greater concentration within the food retail sector, and probably the main kind of, the main costs and adjustments will be felt, other bits of the supply chain largely hit.
And what are the systemic sort of ramifications of that? Does that cause larger scale problems because of the concentration in power and money with certain companies?
Well, there are lots of issues around in supply chains, issues around labor conditions, issues around food adulteration. And so the cost pressures on suppliers are felt much greater, obviously, if you have a power imbalance between the buyer and the seller. If you have a market in which there are lots of sellers and few buyers, then clearly the power lies with the buyer. And so the ways in which those effects, filter through in terms of the incentives that an individual companies have for pushing those adjustments costs onto their workers or onto their commitment to whatever particular obligations they have, then there are incentives for food adulteration, for abuse within supply chain. So the knock-on effects can be hidden, I think, but they are they will be felt. And because obviously the industry is not very equal in terms of the distribution of market power. So some of those effects could be quite egregious further down the supply chain out of the sight of the consumer.
Now, and David, in terms of the logistics industry, I mean, obviously there are problems with this, with systems working. What is the economic fallout? Because, I mean, things still need to be moved around. It's good, things are going to go slower, but will the logistics companies themselves have to absorb extra costs, or is that something that the clients will pay for?
Well, that largely depends on whether there's going to be a free trade agreement. Without a free trade agreement, then the price of a truck will go up 10%, and the price of spare parts will go up around 4%. So, you know, that is a cost. I worked out that that's a cost to the industry of about $250 million a year based on 40,000 trucks.
Mm.
So I think it will be some and some as to where those costs are, how they're divided between the operator and their customers. Ultimately, in the retail space, that will be passed on to consumers. So, you know, I've gone on the record before as saying that without a free trade agreement, there will be inflationary pressures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and also I know in the retail food space, you know, the average estimate, I think, is about 8% on foodstuffs. So, you know, I do believe that without a free trade agreement, where there are going to be inflation in the next 6 months as we see this working out onto the shelves.
Okay, so Ian, we're looking at an average reduction in UK food exports to the EU is 63% in a no-deal scenario, 22% under a free trade agreement anyway, and it's relatively similar in the other way around. Now, how are we going to cope with this, do you think? Is something going to have to give after the required amount of sort of nationalistic muscle flexing to pay homage to the democratic necessity of the Brexit vote? Do you think that after a little game playing has happened, then things are just going to have to relax? All the little England stuff is going to have to relax, and we're going to have to quietly re-enter the EU as a proxy member anyway and apply its rules to ourselves. Otherwise, are we not facing deep economic pain?
Well, I think we are facing a prolonged period of self-inflicted economic pain, and that was the trade-off between sovereignty and profitability was one that was pretty well discussed, if not pretty well understood, during the referendum and since. And the government's made a clear choice in favour of sovereignty. And that's its right. And, you know, in some ways, that debate really did take place during the 2019 general election. So I don't think it's kind of an unknowing choice. But I do agree with you that over time, I think it will be a choice that's reversed. I've always thought that even if there isn't a trade deal concluded in the next 3 or 4 working days, I think there will be, by the end of next year, a trade deal with the EU of sorts. And I think that the important thing about this trade deal, and I speak as someone in his mid-60s, so it's not necessarily going to benefit me in my working career, but I do think that there's an inevitable road back to the sort of seamless, frictionless trade that we currently enjoy for another 8 working days. Over the next decade. I cannot see that any other government that we might imagine, not this government, not a Boris Johnson government, because his colours are pretty firmly pinned to the mast, although not impossible given his hugely flexible political outlook, that even he might move in a different direction under other circumstances. But I think any future Tory Prime Minister or any future other kind of government will inevitably go back to the negotiating table and start to move back in the direction of frictionless trade. And I think that with our biggest trading partner, and that will happen over the next, as I say, over the next decade.
Which is a long time, I guess, and yet a short time. Now, I think, Tony, we talked a little bit about what consumers are going to see in the short term. Can you make any predictions about the long term? We're talking prices, availability of goods. Are we going to have to change our relationship with food and how we buy it?
Yeah. I think this is a key issue. I mean, I think in a way, Stefan, I think when we think about the impact of Brexit on consumers, I mean, they already have felt the effect. You know, since the referendum in June 2016. Sterling has depreciated against the euro by about 12%, you know, and that's given that, you know, 30% of all the food consumed in the UK comes from Europe. That is, you know, that's translated into, you know, into higher price for our food. So we're already in very subtle ways have been feeling the effects of Brexit since 2016. And so I've heard it described, the idea of Brexit's impact upon the UK economy is more like a slow puncher, where, you know, the effects, the economic effects and the effects on prices for consumers will be slow and subtle, but over the longer term will be actually quite substantive. Now, of course, as David was saying, you know, if it's a no deal, then it's going to be more like a blowout than a slow puncher. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I think until we get to the situation that Ian's describing, what we're likely to see is significant inflationary pressures on food, particularly our fresh produce, which is the dominant food import from Europe. So we're likely to see significant price inflation in that area, and potentially issues of scarcity for certain, you know, perishable goods. That as David was suggesting, may not actually survive the duration of transportation once you factor in the inevitable delays caused by extra paperwork, etc. You know, particularly at the Dover Calais Strait. Incidentally, not just for food, but of course, food haulage will also get caught up in the extra bureaucracy that's going to be inflicted upon all of the UK's imports, of which food is obviously an important part. So the effects will be felt, but I think they may be quite drawn out in terms of the ways in which consumers feel these, but ultimately I think that the effects will be quite profound.
Yeah. So David, put yourself at one of the UK's ports on the 1st of January. What's going to happen? Are we going to see chaos or problems or tailbacks then, or is it going to gradually creep in?
Well, I think most lorry drivers do get a holiday break over Christmas and New Year. So I anticipate that this will build up in the first week. I don't believe there will be, it will be at its peak on the 1st of January. It will build up over the first few weeks as that conveyor belt of trucks I talked about earlier gets back into full gear. So the biggest port, where disruption could be felt with the EU is Dover Calais, and I think that's the place to look. And the other one, as Ian alluded to earlier, is Holyhead. They have made some provision for Holyhead in terms of lorry parking, but it's not, the investment there has not been anywhere near on the scale that it has been in the Kent or down the Kent corridor.
Okay, now, if we look at this on a grander scale, there are various scenarios of achieving a deal and not achieving a deal. Elitsa, are these different scenarios dependent on a trade deal, or a lot of these problems and issues, you know, with logistics as well as the whole supply chain, are they there whether or not there's a trade deal?
I think that's one of the things that we have definitely been insisting on people to realize, that some of those issues are definitely to remain regardless of whether there is a deal or no deal. And of course, companies will eventually get used to the new custom procedures. They'll get used to the extra costs. But of course, some of this will entail some longer term adjustments. And for some of the EU producers, for example, that we have been speaking to, that might entail for them to having to reconsider where they are based their operations. They might have to move to the UK, which entails additional investment, which might in turn entail moving investment that has been previewed for other things. So it has this sort of knockdown spillover effect on the industry for sure. Yeah. One of the things that I should have mentioned earlier when you asked me about disruption is definitely that we're not only talking about final products and what comes in the UK for the consumers and producers as a final product, but also a lot of the inputs in industry in the UK food and beverage industry come from Europe. So these are fertilizers, chemicals, even aluminum products. So it's a very complex. We know, of course, that it's complex, but it really goes down to some of the everyday stuff farmers and producers in the UK use. So we do expect that adjustment will take a longer time. And unfortunately, local producers will not have the immediate capacity to jump in and save today, even though we would like to.
Okay, now I don't want to get into the rights and wrongs of Brexit, but Ian, one of the Brexit arguments was that higher tariffs on imports will make people buy more UK products, and this tariff income will go to the government anyway. So it's a win-win situation. I mean, do you see the potential for actual tangible benefits, and as well as we understand that there are going to be a lot of downsides, are there benefits as well for, you know, more UK-based suppliers?
Yeah, there are definitely benefits in the medium and long term, but there aren't very many in the short term. I think the opportunity for what's often described as import substitution is really important. And the only thing I would say about that is that it would be naive to assume that let me just give you one example, and I hope it isn't going to be seen as in some way difficult for the people I name, but if you think that Brie attracts the tariff, French Brie cheese, soft cheese, attracts a tariff of 40%, then it seems unlikely that the British shoppers will continue to buy quite as much at those, if those prices are passed on. But it also seems likely that they do like soft cheese. So British soft cheese producers, particularly Somerset Brie, might well step into the breach. The only thing I would say is that what will happen is while Brie might be priced at a higher price because of the tariff, won't necessarily be all of the tariff that is passed on. It might be some that's absorbed by the retailer and some by the shipper. But what you can expect is that Somerset Brie or the equivalent other products will find a level of price that is not necessarily the one they currently have, but might creep closer to the marker product. And so you will get a degree of price inflation in there, which will be great for producers, but it won't be particularly spectacular for UK shoppers who are already going to be facing all the costs that David referred to earlier. So there are benefits. There's a second benefit in the way in which the UK exporters of food can prosper beyond the EU. And, you know, it's a story that isn't as great for Britain as sometimes we'd like to make it out. So we are not particularly good at food exporting. We're brilliant at exporting Scotch whiskey. But the downside of that is that Scotch whiskey is 20% of UK food exports by value. And one company, for which I used to work actually, so to declare an interest, Diageo, accounts for 10%, half the Scotch whiskey exports in the UK, in the world. And therefore 10% of British food exports is done by one company, which cannot be a healthy situation for the long term.
David, the UK, if it's a more UK-focused food industry, as Ian mentioned, does that mean that there's less opportunity for the international haulage trade?
Well, the international haulage trade is dominated by European-based hauliers. As I said before, 80% of it is European. I think there's an opportunity for the haulage industry to pick up some of that work internally that would have been done by European hauliers when they come over here to deliver product and then do work within the UK before heading back to Europe. So there is definitely an opportunity there. So I think there is going to be, with no deal, there is definitely going to be a challenge for the haulage industry without some compromise over the number of trucks that are allowed into Europe, because that will be governed by a thing called the ECMT permit scheme without some kind of agreement otherwise. And they are short by a factor of 4 to 1. So this is a massive concern for us if there is no trade agreement. You know, the number of businesses that export and included in that would be foodstuffs and Scotch whisky, as Ian talked about, there would be a real difficulty getting into Europe and delivering those products.
Okay, and one last question for you, Tony. What, it's a slight twist on this, but is there an impact on the UK's sort of health as a nation? You know, health inequalities are widening even further during the pandemic, and food supply interruption will hit those in poverty first. Is there a broad scale health situation which combines with the coronavirus problems, which are causing various different pressures on the NHS?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we know all the evidence points to diet is the biggest driver of health inequalities, both, you know, in terms of socioeconomic inequalities, but also across region and between different age groups. But we do need to remember that actually as a country, we don't, you know, by international comparison, we don't actually spend that much on food. So I think the average is about 10% of income on food. And I think even for the bottom quarter of households, it's still only 15%. So there's a bit of a disjuncture between, the availability and prices of food and food poverty, which is in a sense being driven by declining incomes rather than increased food costs. But going back to what I and others have been saying, I mean, the main impact, even with a deal, is likely to be price inflation. And particularly because of our dependence on the EU for fresh produce, fresh fruit and vegetables, that price inflation is going to present consumers with a market signal, which is the precise opposite than the signal the government would want to be sending if it was serious about reducing health inequalities in relation to diet. So I think it is absolutely crucial. It's a crucial consequence that really needs to be watched.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we could talk about this for several hours, but we've got to stop now. One last question to each of you, and you can make this as short or as long as you like, really. What advice would you give to businesses to ensure that they can trade smoothly come 1st of January? This can be a small bit of advice or a huge game-changing bit of advice. Ian, what are you telling your members?
Well, we're giving them all sorts of advice on an hourly basis. So to boil it down into one short aphorism, it's going to be quite tough. I mean, I think I would say two things. The first is just eliminate as many uncertainties and downsides as you can. And the more planning you can do for both the eventuality of a deal and a no deal, the better. We've been saying that to them for months. And we've actually been saying to them that they really need to plan for no deal because the real difference there is tariffs. The other thing I would say is what I always say to all businesses is just make sure that you've got the cash coming in. Just in whatever circumstance that we find ourselves, particularly in this COVID crisis, cash will be king. And therefore, the normal rules of business survival apply. If you've got cash, you'll survive. If you haven't, you won't.
That sounds very sage. Okay, Litsa, what would you say? What advice would you give to businesses?
I'll definitely also confirm what Ian said, preparation. there is a lot that is still unknown and changes on rules surrounding border management procedures and where the IT, whether the IT system will survive. But the more they can do now to prepare, the better they'll be able to handle what's happening in the next year. That just entails doing your research, unfortunately.
And David, is there one key message that you're giving to your members?
If you'll indulge me, I'll say two things. The first is, this is when your trade association really comes into its own. So engage with your trade association. The government is using them extensively. We are there to help you, whether it's the Food and Drink Retailers Association or whoever it is, or Logistics UK, we're there to help you. So please engage with your trade association. The second big concern I've got is all about communication. Please be communicating with your partners in the EU and making sure that they're aware of what's happening and that you've got an agreement as to how, deal or no deal, the product is going to continue to flow.
Excellent. And Tony, what advice would you give to businesses?
Yeah, I would echo everything that's been said. So businesses need to familiarise themselves, if they haven't already, with the paperwork, customs declarations, potential food, health and safety checks, the new freight IT scheme, but most importantly for firms importing, then talk to your suppliers, talk to the hauliers, and as David said, make the most of the peak associations, because they're doing a really good job of getting the message across to their members.
Well, that's fantastic. Ian, Elitsa, David and Tony, thank you so much for joining us today. It has been fascinating, but still a little bit terrifying. I sit here with my fingers crossed in the knowledge that that's pointless and it's simply not enough. So I hope someone gains something out of this living nightmare for the food industry and that things get positive soon. You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast, brought to you by Food Matters, and you heard from Ian Wright, Dr. Elitsa Garnizova, David Wells and Professor Tony Heron, and me, Stefan Gates. Thank you very much. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from salmon farm sustainability to apprenticeships. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Goodbye. You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.